Welcome back from lunch, everyone. I have the privilege of introducing Justice DeWine to our audience today. As you can see from the title of his presentation, he's a very creative and articulate writer. Before being elected to the Supreme Court in 2016, Justice DeWine served 4 years at the First District Court of Appeals and 4 years before that, four years on the Hamilton County Court of Common Pleas. He also teaches as an adjunct faculty member at UC College of Law for appellate advocacy and procedure. And he did graduate from that school up north, but we're going to let him present today anyway. So without further ado, I will turn it over to you, Justice DeWine. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much for having me. It's an honor to be able to do this. And I know there's a lot of folks out there who do a lot to help make our disciplinary process work. So thank you for all of your work. Let me just start by sharing my screen here. See if it gets that. What I'm going to do today, I'm going to talk a little bit about appellate advocacy generally in the Supreme Court. I'm going to talk a little bit about brief writing, but I'm also going to try to have some specifics about the disciplinary process, at least from what I have seen in my thoughts. I did kind of bounce a few things off my colleagues, but I'll just preface everything by saying that these are my thoughts. They're not necessarily anyone else's on the courts. So let me just get this started here. Let me just start out by talking about the real basics. Usually when I do this, I start out by talking about the jurisdictional memorandum and getting your case into the Ohio Supreme Court. But in disciplinary cases, you're there automatically. So at least if there's objections filed, we're gonna hear argument and we're in briefing. So we'll skip over that. But let me just talk about some kind of thoughts on effective brief writing. I always think that whenever you write anything, it's important to start out by thinking about who your audience is. And so if you're writing for us, things to keep in mind are that we're certainly generalist judges. We don't know everything about everything. Make sure you keep your arguments at a level that we can understand and we can relate to. This really isn't so much of a problem in disciplinary cases, but for those of you or other areas of the law, one of the challenges I think is sometimes lawyers forget that judges don't know their case as well as they do. They don't know the background facts. So it's important to present those things. I also think it's important to think about who the individual justices are that are going to be deciding your cases. I think the best appellate advocates sometimes have arguments that are tailored towards different parts of the court, different members of the court. For example, if you were writing a case that dealt with if it's a statutory construction case, and you were talking about legislative history, I'm not particularly interested in legislative history. I'm focused on the text of the statute, but there may be other members of the court, there certainly are, who are a lot more concerned about legislative history. So, think about how you can put your arguments in such a way that they will appeal to different members of the court with their own different judicial philosophies and how they look at different cases. What I tell my students is that in brief writing, you ought to follow the one sitting, two martini rule. That is, you want to write a brief that can be read at one sitting, simple enough, be read at one sitting, and over clear enough, be read over two martinis. I think if you try to think about that rule when you're writing, I think they'll serve you well. So short sentences, the emphasis is really on clarity. We read an awful lot of briefs. And so I think that, the more that you can write something that's clear, that's concise, the more effective your writing will be. use active verbs, avoid redundancy and useless accuracy. I think that, when I'm writing a statement of facts in the case, I think really carefully about what actually needs to be in there. You want to be accurate. You want to convey all the facts, but if you put in unnecessary detail, it's not necessary. You can risk losing your audience. So I think it's a good practice when you write a statement of facts or any kind of factual or any description, going through and saying, okay, why is this sentence? Why is this phrase in there? Does it help me accomplish something in my brief? Does it explain something that needs to be understood, or is it something that can be taken out? I think sometimes, particularly less experienced writers, tend to overuse adjectives and adverbs. I think that when you go through your writing, you can take an awful lot of those out and not lose anything, and make your points more clear. I hate acronyms. I mean, I think that one of the problems that you see in a lot of brief writing is attorneys are too quick to put in acronyms that are not commonly known. If you're talking with the NCAA and AACP, ACLU, acronyms are great because we all understand what they mean. But if your acronym is the NCGKH or whatever, it really can be confusing to the readers. So what I tell people is try to identify parties not by letters, but give them a name that someone can quickly associate with who you're talking about. Same thing goes for statutes. If you're reading a brief and there's a lot of statutory numbers, those are really hard to follow. The reader tends to have to go back each time they see a number and look and say, what statute is that? If you can give those statutes a name, an example, felony sentencing statute from a case I did, or whatever the name is, you can make your writing a lot more readable. I also think it's a good idea to stay away from plaintiff, defendant, appellant, appellee. That can get confusing. Usually when the reader sees that, they need to take a step in their mind and say, okay, who's the plaintiff? Who's the defendant? Particularly, and it gets even worse when you get an appellant or defendant appellant. So I think you're a lot better off giving people names. I know in a lot of disciplinary counsel cases, you're going to be talking about relator and respondent. That's a little less confusing because we're all pretty clear about who that is. But I generally think that you can add clarity by identifying people by their names, identifying the board by this the board, and I think that makes it easier for your reader to understand. So. Here's an example of what we're talking about when I say useless accuracy and other writing problems. Here's a sentence that you can see there's passive voice, redundancy, things that useless accuracy, things that you just don't really need to know. And if you read that, your mind just kind of, you just kind of tend to drift off. You can rewrite that sentence pretty easily. Like John Doe alleges his son Johnny sustained a permanent brain injury, et cetera. And that's a much more easier sentence to read. I think that's what we ought to be striving to, whether we're judges writing opinions or whether we're litigants writing briefs. I think it's helpful to help the reader understand. Sometimes the reader needs to be able to put things in context. They need to understand how this works, where it fits into the world. So when I write opinions, I'm big on providing background facts if they help understand, not things that are going to change what's in the record, but just the things to help put it in context for people. You can see here's one example from a Texas case. I am a big believer in visual aids. you know, most of us, at least people my age and older, we grew up in worlds where we started writing on typewriters or not very sophisticated word processing machines. Today, you can do so much with word processing programs. You can put pictures in, you can put diagrams in. And I think lawyers often don't take enough advantage of that. I mean, we are taught as lawyers to take pictures and other things and put them into Word, but sometimes things work better when they're not in Word. It's easier to understand. So here's a case I had where I wrote the opinion, and it was kind of a weird case. It was about what a sentencing entry, what certain marks on the sentencing entry meant. And I wrote it out and explained what the marks were. But at some point I realized, you know, it's just a lot easier to show the reader what this sentencing entry looked like. And that explains it a lot better. And I think that there's no reason that you can't do things like that when you're brief writing. Don't be afraid to take that picture or take the picture of the sentence out of the contract or whatever, if the context is relevant, to use a picture to show what you're trying to explain. I'm a big believer in using charts and graphics when it makes sense. So this is from an opinion I wrote where I was trying to comparing two statutory provisions. And on the first draft, I had done one paragraph quoting the first statute, and I did another paragraph with a block quote from the second statute. And then, finally figured out that, okay, instead of having the reader have to go back and forth and try to compare the difference going up and down the page, if you put them side by side, which is kind of the way we tend to read things and look at things, it was a lot easier. So that's what we did in that case. And I think, you can think about the same kind of things when you're writing opinions or you're writing briefs. How do you get rid of those big blocks of text that are hard to read? I always tell people that the best way to be a better writer is to be a conscious reader. That is to stop and think about, when you're reading sometime, try to be conscious of when your mind drifts, what you tend to gloss over, what you don't read as carefully as you probably should. And if you do that, odds are that your readers, that the readers of your work are probably going to do the same thing. So think about how you can change, how you can change your writing so that you can do those things. There was a question that I just saw about whether didn't see the PowerPoints in the materials, but I'm happy to share those with anyone. I'm sure that you can either get them from me, or I'm sure Joe would be willing to, Caligari would be willing to pass them on as well. I'm happy to share these if anyone's interested in them. I am a believer in headings. I don't think you have to use headings. I think there's effective writing that doesn't use headings, but I like to use headings to kind of orient my reader and tell them what's coming next. Imagine someone tells you to watch an inning of a baseball game and then says, I'm going to ask you a question later. And you watch the inning of the baseball game, and then they say, okay, my question is, was the pitcher putting an illegal substance on the ball? Well, no one told you what you were looking for, so you may have been watching the batter or the outfielder or who knows what else. But if someone said to you before that, watch this inning of the baseball game and see if the pitcher is doctoring the ball, then you know what you're looking for and you are able to pay attention to the right thing. It's the same thing when we're reading, right? If I see a heading that says, It's a statement of facts, and the heading says, the pitcher doctors the ball. Then when I'm reading that, going through all different facts about the game, I know what to look for. Or if it's a heading like, you know, the defendant shoots the victim after a brawl. When I'm reading this incident of the brawl, I kind of know what I need to keep my eyes on. So I think headings can do the same thing. They help you know where the writer is going, so it helps orient the reader about what to pay attention to. And so I'm a believer in, you know, headings like Smith organizes conspiracy, limit price hikes instead of argument of facts. There's other ways to do it. I think good topic sentences can accomplish much the same purpose, but I think headings are one effective way anyway. Don't make it personal. And I think this for most of us, this is pretty obvious advice, but you know, we read a lot of briefs and we do see some of these things violated from time to time. And I think they tend to give a bad impression of the author and attorney. So, you know, I don't really like to see briefs when someone really attacks opposing counsel. If opposing counsel did something, spell it out and let us draw our own conclusions. Same with attacks on the trial court. Judges tend to look at lower courts. And this would also go for, it would go for a panel or go for the board if we were reading a brief. But we tend to look at lower courts as colleagues, not as people that we supervise. Or so, you know, when we see attacks on trial judges or lower panels, that doesn't usually sit too well. I think that a lot of the language like travesty of justice, insult to intelligence, disingenuous, feckless, that kind of language. Again, we read a lot of briefs and it's not very effective. I can't tell you how many briefs I read where someone responds and says the other side's argument is disingenuous. Well, you know, there are some things that are disingenuous in the world, but not everything is. Again, I think you're much better off showing us why something is disingenuous than just starting out by labeling another person's position that way. Avoid naked appeals to sympathy. I think that should be fairly obvious, but I think, you know, particularly sometimes attorneys who are more used to advocating at a trial level tend to put some of those things in their briefs or sometimes in oral arguments. And those things tend to kind of leave a kind of a bad taste in an appellate judge's mouth. It can be kind of feel a little insulted, but we feel like that's not something that we are looking at. And I don't think it's good for the attorney who makes those kinds of arguments. Tell the court why it should decide to you, fight for you. You know, what is the rule you want the court to write? What impact will the rule have in other cases? And I think that's really important. That's what we're thinking about as judges. You know, when I'm looking at a case, I am, one of my big worries is that I'm going to write this rule. I'm going to decide this case, and that's going to create a rule. And that rule is going to be just fine in this case, but there's going to be some unintended consequences somewhere else. It's going to be used in a way that I never had envisioned. So I'm always worried about those things. Litigants don't really think about that too often because they're thinking about their own case. But if you put yourself in the judge's perspective, you need to think about that because that's what we're worried about oftentimes. My question, what should you use instead of respondent? I would just use their name, either their last name or their first name. To me, that's easier to follow than respondent. But again, I'm not sure everyone would see it that way. But that would be my preference. I think that's easier to follow. Tell the court why it should decide for you. What is the policy underlying the precedents you've cited? It's great that if you cite precedents that support your position, but unless those precedents are ones from the U.S. Supreme Court that we're bound to follow, I think it's helpful to explain what are the reasons behind those precedents. How do those fit in? Why do we have those precedents? Because for us, unless it's something that we're bound to follow, which is really a decision of the U.S. Supreme Court and to some extent our prior precedent, although we can change that. So it's not always all that persuasive just to say that, okay, some other court decided this way. Explain that, but also explain why they did. I think that helps make your arguments much more persuasive. Why should the court rely on the cases in brief? If you're citing cases, explain to me why I should rely on those. I mean, if it's a higher court, it's obvious, but otherwise, what besides the fact that some other court decides something this way would make me want to rely on? Is it really persuasive? Has this been universally adopted? Is this the trend in modern other states? Is this a court with particular expertise in this area? When I write, I spend the most amount of time in any part of my brief on the introduction. If you look at my opinions, they're fairly similar in that they usually have a first paragraph. Sometimes it's two, every once in a while it's three, but usually it's one or two. That lay out what the issue is, explain how we're going to decide it, and that tries to get the reader's attention. So I try to write something that's interesting, that's easy to read. I try to get rid of citations and other kinds of parentheticals and all that in my introduction. I want something that's real easy, real simple, that I know the reader is going to follow up front, and hopefully that he or she will be interested in this case and they'll want to keep reading. And I think, when you're writing a brief, I think it's the same way. I think if you can write an introduction that gets the reader oriented to what you're going to talk about, tells them a little where you're going to go, I think that's helpful. Not too much. I mean, I think that I don't like briefs where they write an introduction that basically tells me everything the brief's going to tell me. I think that's, then you risk getting repetitive, but something that kind of lays out what this case is about and where you're going, I think can be very helpful and can help set the tone for the rest of your brief. I think it's obviously important in legal writing to include the standard of review. But what I tell people is, don't just drop in a boilerplate paragraph that says standard of review. You see that all the time in brief writing. I'm sure a lot of you have seen that in legal opinions, but I would ask you, what do you do when you see that in a legal opinion? Odds are you probably skip over it. When we see something we recognize as boilerplate, our tendency is just to skip over it and go to the next paragraph. And I think judges do the same thing. We're human. We read the same way other people do. So I think identify the standard of view, certainly, but weave it into your opinion. In disciplinary cases, if you're writing for this court, we say we have independent review over the decisions of the panel and the board. I'll talk a little bit more about that later on, but essentially, we don't give deference to the board. I think in practice we probably do, and again, I'll talk about that overall. But the technical standard review is that we have independent review. So you should write your argument, weaving that into how you explain what you think we should do.
That's a good segue into our first poll question, Justice DeWine.
Great. Let's see, I have a question here, which I will go ahead and answer. And the question is, in writing a well-written brief, would the best outline to be to follow a statement of facts, law, analysis, conclusion? I think that's generally the best way to write a brief. I mean, I think generally you want to have some introduction that explains, you know, where you're going. And I think you need to have some introduction before you get to the facts, or it's really hard to understand what the facts are. And I think generally most of us write legal opinions, putting the law next and then applying the law to the facts is pretty, I think that's pretty standard. But what I tell people is that, you know, legal writing can sometimes be like the, they say in architecture, form follows function. And I think sometimes the form of how you write just changes based on what makes the most sense for what you're trying to explain. So sometimes before I get to the facts, there might be a statutory provision that's really important, and the facts really don't make any sense unless you're explaining the facts in terms of the statutory standard, or the reader needs to understand it. So sometimes I'll put some of the law up front. I'll say this case involves a statute that says what. So I think you have to be willing to do that when you write, if you're going to change your structure to make it work for what you're doing. I put this quote up about editing. I really think editing is probably the most important part of the process. Think about the friend that you have who always tells you the same story over and over again. What do you do when you start to hear that story? If you're like me, your mind drifts off. You start thinking about the World Series or what you're going to have for lunch or something else. Because you've heard the story. Readers are the same way. If you're reading a brief and someone is telling you the same thing they told you three other times in that brief, odds are that you're going to lose your reader. So I think making your briefs, I think good editing, cutting out the dead wood, pruning out the dead wood, will help make you a much better writer. There's actually one of my favorite books on legal writing. Isn't a book on legal writing at all. It's a book by Stephen King, kind of about his writing techniques. And what he says is kind of the first time you write, you're writing for yourself. You're putting everything in that you think needs to go in there. And you need to kind of understand this and put it all together. But then when you go through it, you got to think about your reader. Okay, what doesn't the reader really have to need to see here? What can I take out? What have I already said in a section, in the facts section? Or what can I move from the facts section to the argument section? You know, how do I avoid repeating the facts twice in both sections? So I think just going back and back over and trying to figure out what's absolutely necessary and getting rid of the rest will really serve you well. I did a seminar one time and someone said to me, as a criminal defense attorney, and she said, I always feel like I'm not serving my client well if I don't use all the pages I'm allotted in my brief. And, I was kind of shocked by that, because I shouldn't have been. That's not the case at all. You're serving your client the best by making something that's just readable and that's going to hold someone's attention. I think I've said three or four times, we just read briefs all the time. So the most effective ones are the ones that can really hold someone's attention. And I think tight editing accomplishes a whole lot in that area. I have a question about what do judges discuss about cases in conference, and Just hold on. We're going to get to conference pretty soon. So let me, a few more thoughts on editing. A couple things I do. I play a game with the edit, kind of a little game with myself. Once I've got something I think is in pretty good shape, I'll look at the word count on the document. So it might be 10,000 words or whatever. And then what I do is I'll go through the documents and I'll look at how many words are the next time through, and I'll write it on a little post-it and just keep trying to eliminate as many words as possible. So hopefully at the end of the process, I started out with the top of the post-it said 10,000 words and I got it down to 8,500 or some other number, but I've been able to cut things out that were unnecessary. So I was trying to think about, I know that some of you are writing Board of Professional Conduct opinions, and I was trying to think about, what I thought about those, if I had any suggestions for writing the opinions. I talked to a few of my colleagues as well. I think generally the formats and the way they're written works pretty well for us. It gives us the information that needs. Typically, they're written with kind of a findings of fact, conclusions of law sections, which I think in this context are pretty helpful. The only thing that really struck me that I think would help a lot is I spend an awful lot of time when I'm reading Board of Professional Conduct opinions going back and looking at the rules. So for example, a Board of Professional Conduct opinion will cite a rule, but much of the time, probably the majority of the time, there's never any reference to the text of the rule. And when I'm looking at a disciplinary violation, I am looking closely at what the text of the rule is and tying that to the facts. I think that, if some of these opinions, and the same goes for briefs as well. I see a lot of briefs that don't really quote the text of the rule. I think setting that out, maybe in a heading, maybe at the beginning of a section, or however you do it, but putting the text in front of us so it's easy to find, and then tying the violation to the actual language of the rule. Attorney Smith violated rule, the provision of rule 8.1 or whatever, that an attorney shall not quote, and then close quote, and then by doing such and such. So I think if you can tie those things together, I think it would help us in our review. I think it would make the arguments or the opinions a little bit easier to follow, and as well as some of the briefs. But I went back and I read a few before this. I talked to people. That was really the only thing that jumped out at me. I think generally opinions are pretty well done. At least for what we need out of them, they're pretty easy to get at. So thank you for that. All right, so let's talk a little bit about oral argument. Before I do that, though, I have a question that I really like. It's from Joe. How do you feel about using footnotes to lay out the text of the rules? I generally don't like footnotes. I think footnotes distract the reader. You have to move your head from the top, from what you're reading, down to the footnotes. So generally, I'm not a fan of footnotes. I think that when I write, I try to have none or very few footnotes. There's a few things I think you have to put to just you need to put in footnotes because they need to be in there, but they're such beside the point that you really don't want to put them in the text. I I would rather, when it comes to what the text of the rule is, I would rather see the rule in a footnote than not see it in the brief. I can go down and look at that. But, you know, I if I were writing a brief, I would put that right out front because, you know, to me, this is the law that you have to, if you're writing a brief, this is the law that, you know, depends on which side you're on, obviously, but if you're disciplinary counsel, this is the law that you have to show the attorney violated, just like any other statute or anything else. So I would want that out front, in the beginning of my argument or right before I laid out the text. That's probably what I would do, but if the choice is between putting them in a footnote or not putting it in at all, I'd much rather have a footnote than have to go look them up all the time. So oral argument. Let's talk about oral argument a little bit. The good news is the last time I did this presentation, I had all these slides about Zoom oral argument, and I was very happy to take them all out because we're done with Zoom oral arguments. I know a few courts are still doing them, but I hope by and large, at least in our court, that we're back in person to stay. Just cross your fingers anyway. So let's talk about oral arguments. Just some of the basics. Supreme Court practice rule 1304A1 talks about oral argument in disciplinary cases. We're going to schedule oral argument in a case where there's objections and briefs filed generally. So, you know, if there's an objection filed, you're going to be scheduled for oral argument. 13.4A2 allows any party to waive oral argument. If one party waives, that does not automatically waiver for the other one. So if you waive oral argument and your opponent doesn't, then your opponent will be in front of the court and you won't. I always get the question, should you waive oral argument? I think that's really, in any case, it's kind of a strategic decision about, you know, how you feel about the briefs, whether oral argument is going to, you think, make your case better or not. I think in a case, if I am the appellant, I would be very reluctant to waive oral argument. I would feel like, okay, it's kind of my, you know, I'm the person that has to show that there was a mistake below. I don't want to lose any last opportunity to do that. In disciplinary cases, I would think that if it's an attorney who's been disciplined, and you filed objections, you're trying to change the decision of the board. I would think you would be very reluctant to waive oral argument because I think, you're the one that has to show that you're trying to show that the board made a mistake or got something wrong. So I would not want to give up that opportunity. At least if you're represented by counsel, I will say that, everyone knows the adage about an attorney representing himself having a fool for a client. I will say that I think that it's particularly doesn't, at least in my experience, doesn't work very well for attorneys who are facing discipline to argue their own cases. I would hazard to guess that in the ones that I've witnessed in the 5 years in the court, the attorneys have probably hurt themselves more than they've helped themselves. So I would certainly urge people to go out and get someone else, hire someone else to argue your case. I think it's really tough in a disciplinary case to represent yourself in oral arguments. If I was disciplinary counsel, if I was bar association and the attorney had waived oral arguments, would I waive oral argument? I think that's probably fine. I think the other side has. I think we're probably generally going to get the information we need from the brief, assuming it's the attorney facing discipline who's the one that's filed the objections. But I think, these are really things that have to be decided on a case-by-case basis. So what do you do at oral arguments? And again, I think this is advice that most of you know, but here's what I tell people is, you really do need to treat oral argument like a conversation. The attorneys who do well in oral argument are the attorneys who know the law, who know the facts, and come in prepared to answer any question the justice is going to ask. I think that, I think if you prepare well, you shouldn't be surprised by too many questions. And that may involve doing some moot oral arguments, having some other folks look at this case and see what the strengths and weaknesses are. I'm a big believer in that. I think that really helps. But come in and, have three or four points you want to make, but really treat it like a conversation. I think the people that do well are attorneys that do that. The attorneys who don't do well are the attorneys who have a speech and they want to give that speech. They have memorized or written down that speech, and whatever you ask them, you're not going to get them off their speech. And that can be frustrating, I think, for the justices who, may have their minds, may be perfectly clear where they are about 90% of the case, but want to explore 10%. So I don't think it serves the attorneys very well. I think that, cases are generally decided probably 90%, 95% on the briefs. So when you get to oral arguments, it's not necessary that you re-argue your whole case. The questions you're going to get are really more important than what your script is. Spend time, try to answer the questions. We don't like it when people try to avoid our questions. Sometimes we'll ask a question and someone will say, oh, well, that's not my case. That's hypothetical. That's not my case. Well, believe it or not, we don't ask hypotheticals because we want to show we're really smart or because, we think it'd be fun to be a law school professor. We generally ask hypothetical questions because what I mentioned before, we're worried about the impacts of a decision this case will have in other cases. So that's why we ask those questions. So they really are important. So, answer those questions. I think attorneys get in trouble in oral argument when they don't acknowledge weaknesses, when they won't concede the most obvious point. I think that kind of causes you to lose credibility. Most cases have weaknesses. I don't think there's anything wrong with acknowledging the weaknesses in your case, but being able to explain why you still are entitled to prevail. I tell if you are blessed and you are Clarence Darrow and you can walk in and you're just a great oral advocate, silver tongue, that's great. But what I tell people is really the most important thing about oral argument is knowing your case, knowing the facts and knowing the law. If you know the facts and the law really well, you will do fine in oral argument, no matter how glib you are. If you don't know the facts and the law, being the best oral in the world is not going to save your case. So, it really is a case where I think when you go to things like this, you hear seminars, you hear a lot about kind of the style things, and style's fine, but it's really the substance, I think, is really what matters at oral arguments.
We'll go ahead and launch our second polling question here, Justice DeWine.
Great. So is there anything different about disciplinary cases in oral arguments? I think generally the same considerations apply. I do think that it's important to make sure you know the facts. We have had cases in oral argument where the party prosecuting the case, we've asked questions and we're unclear about the facts. I think that's never a good thing. So even if you weren't familiar with the case below, make sure you really understand the record. Make sure you understand what the law is, what the actual text, what the rule says. I think based on what we do every day, we're pretty focused on what the text of the rule is, you know, what the statutory question, at least I am. And I think sometimes you get kind of the sense of disciplinary cases where this guy or this woman did a bunch of really bad things, and so therefore they should be disciplined. I'm like, okay, that's probably right, but you need to tie that to what the actual law says. So don't lose sight of, you know, what the actual rules in question are. What the sanction is, I think that, you know, you're going to get questions. You may get questions from the court about other cases. There are some members of the court who are very focused and very good at kind of comparing this case to other cases, and worrying that the sanction is out of whack in this case compared to what we've done in other cases. So you have to be aware of those cases. I know it's hard because of the fact that disciplinary cases come to them automatically. They're not discretionary like other cases. We decide a lot of cases, so you have a lot of factual situation. Every factual situation is a little different, but it's easy to argue that this case, you know, that the case in front of us is out of whack with some other case. So I think you need to think about those kind of questions, be able to respond to them. I do think that, you know, disciplinary cases are a little different for attorneys arguing them than maybe, you know, a dispute between two private parties. I think, you know, if you are on the Bar Association side, disciplinary counsel side, I think it is important to, you know, have the kind of, you know, we look at you as an advocate, yes, but you're also representing the public, you're representing the legal profession. So I think it's particularly important that you not appear that you're being overly zealous or overly prosecutorial, that you have that role over the public, and that you are trying, in the role of an advocate, also trying to be fair. Some of the same things that you would ask from a prosecutor in a case. Let's see. I have another question. If an objecting respondent does not appear for oral argument, how should the relator approach its argument? I would think that if I were the relator, and again, it may depend on the case, may depend on how strong the argument the objecting respondent raised, but I would probably try to get up there and kind of summarize, you know, what the three points were, but I would probably try to do it pretty quickly. I mean, I think this is probably a case where most times you don't want to take all 15 minutes. You can probably do it in 5 and then, you know, leave plenty of time for questions. Because if there's things that we're worried about, we will ask you. I mean, yeah, I guarantee you, if it's a case where someone has kind of glommed on or thinks that the objections are important, you're going to hear that. So I think, you know, in a case like that, probably the most important thing is to kind of make sure that you give the court time to, you know, ask the questions. And then if there is an issue that's, you know, one or more members of the court have, you can address that part of it, you know, in detail. Okay, so this is kind of the inside baseball part. What happens after oral argument? We've heard the case. Now, what do we do? So what we're going to do is we're going to go upstairs. We have a conference room on the 9th floor, and we'll huddle. We get together, and I was asked by someone. I do this as a road show, and so I was giving this presentation, I guess, in northeast Ohio, and they asked me if I changed the football team depending on where I am. So the answer is no. I always use the Browns. I do that because I'm a Bengals fan, so I figure I'll try to be fair. But it looks like the Bengals are better this year. So far, we'll see what happens a week from Sunday. So anyway, we huddle. We go back to our conference room. You can see it there. Now, what I'm going to tell you now is not the procedure in disciplinary cases, but let me back that up. So we'll go to our conference room, and in any case, if it's been argued, what will happen is the chief will sit around this conference table. We sit in order of seniority, and the chief will call a case. So we'll call first case argued, she'll call it. Then she will say what she thinks about that case, how she thinks it should come out. Then we work our way around the room in order of seniority. So Justice Kennedy, who's a senior associate justice, goes first, and we work our way down to the most junior justice, Jennifer Bruner, right now. Each one of the justices can speak once, and it's completely uninterrupted. And that seems easy enough, but actually, it's not that easy, at least for me. You know, I have a tendency to want to jump in and kind of argue, or if I think someone's got something wrong, help kind of point them in the right direction. But if you do that, you get cut off. So you get one time through, no one can interrupt. And I grew up in a family with seven brothers and sisters. That would have been a fantastic rule for our dinner table, but it most certainly was not the rule, but it is our rule. So we'll go through once everyone's speaking, and then after that, it's kind of a free-for-all. And then we'll get a vote. And so when we vote, we start after kind of the free-for-all, after everyone's talked as much as we want, we'll take a vote. We vote from the most junior justice all the way up to the chief. And so a case will come out 4-2, 5-2, 4-3, whatever it is. Then we have to decide who's going to write the opinion. So this opinion party, it doesn't apply to disciplinary case. I'll get to that in a second. But in most cases, we have to decide what justice is going to author the opinion. You may know that in the United States Supreme Court, the Chief Justice signs the opinion to another justice in the majority. We're a lot more sophisticated than that in Ohio. We play a dice game. So you'll see on the right side of your screen, there's this leather bottle. It came out of a pool hall in Cleveland. I think it's been around the court for decades. Actually, the picture doesn't do justice for how beat up the bottle, nor the dye things, actually what we call them pills, are. But anyway, each pill corresponds to a justice. So right now, I am number four. And what happens is the pills of the justices who are in the majority go in the bottle. And then the senior associate justice will roll the bottle, and whoever's pill comes out gets assigned to write the majority opinion. And we have a process where we keep track of who gets which case so that your pill doesn't go back in the bottle to everyone else has gotten one. So we even out the writing assignments. But that's how we write the opinions. And then once that happens, justice will go back to chambers, work with their law clerks, write an opinion, be circulated to the other justices. And then at that point, anyone else can weigh in. So someone may write dissent, someone may write a concurrence. And then once all that happens, comes back to the table, and we take another vote. This one's kind of more a real vote. And if the majority stays a majority, then that opinion gets voted out and gets released. But if the votes change in the sense that the dissent gets more votes than the majority, or concurrence gets more votes than what was originally the majority, then that opinion will become the majority opinion, and everyone will have to rewrite their opinion. So the dissent would have to make theirs into majority, and vice versa, then it would come back and be voted on again. That's how we do it in the ordinary case. Disciplinary cases are a little different. What happens in a disciplinary case is that we have master commissioners who are assigned to the case. So these are folks who work for the court, who kind of staff attorneys. We have certain ones who are assigned to disciplinary cases. So in a disciplinary case, the first thing will happen is we'll go through, we'll vote the same way, but then the case will be assigned to a master commissioner. And that master commissioner will write a per curiam opinion on behalf of the court. Then that will be circulated. At that point, any justice can weigh in. So sometimes you will see in disciplinary cases, a justice will write a dissent or concurrence. Once those are written, we'll come back and we'll vote on those again. Sometimes the dissent will get more votes. Then that just, if that happens, that justice will make their dissent into a majority opinion. And once that's done, we'll vote on it again. Hopefully it will get ultimately get voted out of conference. I guess one little insight then is if you see a disciplinary case that has a justice's name on its majority opinion, what that means is that actually started out as a dissent or a concurrence, then got more votes than per curiam, and so ultimately became the decision of the court. Let's see. I want to talk a little bit about, so how do we discuss these cases? When we're talking about disciplinary cases around the table, what do we think about? Again, we say we have independent review of disciplinary cases. So we have, regardless of what the board or the panel did, we look at them independently. We say that, but I think in practice, we're probably a little bit more deferential, but I think it kind of depends on what the issue is. If we're dealing with purely a legal question, someone says, okay, I was disciplined for violating this rule, but I had a First Amendment right to say what I said. I think you're going to see almost purely de novo review. We're going to look at what we think the law is. We're not going to give any deference to what the panel or the board thought the law was. So I think in those cases, it really is, regardless of how it really is, purely independent de novo review. When it comes to questions of fact, we've said different things. Kind of similar things. We said in some cases you can see a quote, while this court is not bound by the findings of fact of the board and panel, we give them some deference in light of the reality the panel observed the witnesses firsthand. In another case, we've said we ordinarily defer to a panel's credibility determinations in our independent review of professional discipline cases unless the record weighs heavily against those findings. I think the reality is at least when it comes to a factual matter, particularly something that's credibility, what depends on something that the panel, heard the witness testimony, we're going to give a fair amount of deference to what the panel decided, unless there's something in the record that really makes us think that was wrong. Sanctions. I think that's an interesting question. Again, as we say, we have independent review, so we don't have to give any deference to it, but. I think in practice, there's at least some, I think for me, I tend to be pretty deferential. I think I didn't hear the case. If the panel and the board heard it and they came to a particular sanction, I'm inclined to go with that unless it seems, out of the way off, or unless it seems kind of, an outlier among our other cases. I think some people probably are a little less deferential to kind of sanctioned decisions. I think the standard is really we don't have to give any deference. But I think we do tend to appreciate the fact that there are people who've heard the testimony, who've worked hard. They were in the position of, pretty much like a finder of fact would be, like a trial court would be. And I try not to lightly disregard what those findings were, at least when it comes to kind of the factual question and the sanction question. If I think the board or panel is wrong with the law, then I certainly wouldn't hesitate to dissent or to, vote to overrule that decision. Let's see. So that kind of brings us to the end. Let's see. I have some questions. So these are good questions. One question is, do justices make suggested edits to each other's draft opinions? Yeah, we do. It kind of depends on the justice, how we do those. But typically what I would do is I'm going to see another justice opinion, and if I don't like the style, if I don't like the construction or the writing, I'm not going to make any of those edits. You know, even if I don't like the grammar, I'm not going to make an edit unless it's obviously incorrect. I just don't want the colleague to be embarrassed. But I do make suggestions where I think there's something in the opinion that would cause me discomfort, so I couldn't join it. So there might be a case where, a justice talks about the law and maybe goes to a place that's really not necessary to decide the case. I don't agree with him about that, but I can, there is a part of what he's saying that I agree on, or there is a reason to decide the case with which I agree. So I might take a red line and make some red line comments or suggestions in their opinion, send it to them and see if they can accept those. That's fairly common. Again, I try to be deferential. I don't do anything except really substantive things that I think would change whether or not I would join the opinion. But that's certainly what I do. When an opinion draft is circulated, do you have any tips for dealing with your colleagues who suggest edits that you don't agree with for whatever reason? How do you avoid several justices trying to micromanage an opinion? Those are some pretty specific questions. It's really, and it's hard to answer in the abstract because, on any kind of collegial court, interpersonal relations are really important, and you kind of get to know people and you have different strategies for dealing with different colleagues. I know some of my colleagues are very easy to, take edits. Other ones, it may be more difficult. It just really depends on colleague. But I think you need to just kind of develop those relationships. As far as how do you avoid several justices micromanaging an opinion, I think you really can't always avoid that. But I think that, this goes both ways. So we know that if I'm going to micromanage someone else's opinion, they're probably going to try to do it to me. So you kind of, I think that puts a natural check on it. You don't ask someone to do something that would bother you if someone asked you to do. It's kind of the way I look at it. So I see Rick and Joe are both on the screen. So I guess I'm over my time, but let me just put some contact info up there.
Justice DeWine, thank you so much. It was very informative and very relevant to what we do. So we really appreciate your time.
Absolutely. Happy to do it. So
thank you very much.
Enjoy their weekend.